14, as I've mentioned numerous times now, next two, probably 3 weeks, we will be speaking of the role of women in the assembly, the role of women in the church setting. This is brought up because there have been a few questions about this dating back some months now, and even Mr. Troy and I were talking about this a little bit today, that I feel to some degree that it has maybe tied my hands a little bit, because I don't feel as authoritative as maybe I should be on the issue, and maybe you don't feel as authoritative as you should be on the issue. And what that does is it makes me a little less creative, because I don't want to overstep bounds, and perhaps it has hindered some of you from being participatory. And so there is this, I feel like I've been in a bit of a deadlock for the past couple of months as far as creativity and such, and I would like that to be resolved. However, it takes time to study this out, to get to a place where I feel comfortable and able to speak on it. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. These are good things. When questions like this arise, what it causes us to do is go to the Bible. And so there are three particular passages that I'm going to be covering with you. And these passages, 1 Corinthians 14 is one that we'll be talking about. And that's the one that, Lord willing, we'll get through tonight. And then I will be taking you to 1 Timothy chapter 2. And we'll be talking about that admonition. And then we'll be going to 1 Corinthians 11 and speaking about that one. Now, and those are the three primary passages I could find directly referencing women's role in the assembly. There are many examples, but we need to be careful with examples, because we really don't know the context behind them. We really don't know what's happening. And so we can use examples as that. Examples. We can say, okay, this can lead us in a particular direction, but those examples must not be at the expense of the teaching that is in Scripture. It can be to help guide us where the direct teachings of Scriptures don't help us. And so that is my heart this evening, that we can understand this issue more thoroughly. The first two passages, the 1 Corinthians 14 and the 1 Timothy 2, are prohibitions that I want us to understand within their context. The third, the 1 Corinthians 11, is more of a command that we need to understand within its context. And really, the context is the key to all of these. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, look at verses 34 and 35 with me. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. That seems very straightforward, and that seems extremely prohibitive. If we were to take this at face value, reading just those two verses, without reading anything around it, what we would find is this. The minute you walk through the doors of this church, the women are supposed to shut their mouths, and that it's not supposed to open again until they leave the church. Maybe we could stretch it and say, okay, well, let's just call it the sanctuary. So women, if you want to say anything, leave the sanctuary, because that's where we're worshiping, and then you can open your mouth. But if it's not in the sanctuary, then if it's in the sanctuary, then that is what we would gather. But throughout history, we've seen that in various sects and various partitions of religion, but we haven't seen that really mainstream. Even in that Bible-believing thread throughout history. And so, where do we go with this passage? What do we do with this passage? That's what we need to talk about. And that's what we're going to talk about. So, 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is a book of rebuke. We know that. 1 Corinthians 14, 12, 13, and 14 in particular are speaking directly concerning spiritual gifts. We know this. We recognize 1 Corinthians 13 to be that love chapter, the chapter on charity. And Paul is emphasizing in 1 Corinthians 13 the superiority of charity to those other gifts. If you turn back for a moment, to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning in verse 29, he says, "Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Have all the gift of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret?" And then he says, "But covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way." Now he had talked about the best gifts being those particularly that edify others. And then he says, but hey, there is a more excellent way still. And that is the lead into, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity." And he says, love is the more excellent way. And so he goes through the chapter on charity, and then he says, in beginning of chapter 14, verse 1, "Follow after charity and desire spiritual gifts, but rather that ye may prophesy. For speaking in an unknown tongue, for he that speaketh in an unknown tongue, speaketh not unto men, but unto God. For no man understandeth him, howbeit in the Spirit he speaketh mysteries." So we are in a spiritual gifts section. Chapter 14 is yet speaking of spiritual gifts, specifically the superiority of a term called prophecy over this gift of tongues. Paul is exhorting believers exactly how they should go about the process of speaking in tongues within the church body. And that is really the context of 1 Corinthians 14. I prefer that you prophesy, but let me give you some instruction as far as an orderly way to use this gift of tongues in the church. And let's walk through this chapter together, get some context. I'm sorry, we're probably going to go a little past 8:30 tonight, which I don't think has ever hindered anyone in this room in the past, so I'm not going to worry about it. But let's go ahead and go through this together. Verses 1 through 5 is an appeal to pursue prophecy, which we'll see the definition in a moment, as opposed to tongues. So an appeal basically to pursue this idea of edification above this sign gift to unbelievers. Read it with me, beginning in verse 1. "Follow after charity and desire spiritual gifts, but rather that ye may prophesy. For he that speaketh in an unknown tongue speaketh not unto men, but unto God. For no man understandeth him, howbeit in the Spirit he speaketh mysteries. But he that prophesieth speaketh unto men to edification and exhortation and comfort." There, he just defined what he means by prophecy. Exhortation, edification, and comfort. "He that speaketh in an unknown tongue edifieth himself, but he that prophesieth edifieth the church. I would that ye all spake with tongues, but rather that ye prophesied. For greater is he that prophesieth than he that speaketh with tongues, except he interpret, that the church may receive edifying." So he says it's no good if there's no edification. If you're going to have tongues, you definitely need to have an interpreter, but I would sure rather that everyone prophesied, that everyone exhorted, edified, and comforted in the church. Verse 6, that was verses 1 through 5 that appeal. Verses 6 through 12, Paul argues regarding the necessity within the context of tongues of clarity, order, and distinction in the teaching of the church. "Now, brethren, if I come unto you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you, except I shall speak to you either by revelation or by knowledge or by prophesying or by doctrine?" If I come into the church and I start speaking in tongues, it doesn't help anybody. But if I come with knowledge, with doctrine, with prophesying, we've already defined that as edification, as exhortation, and as comfort, or with revelation, then you are learning something. Then there is edification. Then there is mutual building up one of another. Then something is happening. "And even things without life-giving sound," verse 7, "whether pipe or harp, except they give a distinction in the sound, shall it be known what is piped or harped? For if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to battle? So likewise, except ye utter by the tongue words easy to be understood, how shall it be known what is spoken? For ye shall speak into the air. There are, it may be, so many kinds of voices in the world, and none of them is without signification. Therefore, if I know not the meaning of the voice, it shall be unto him that speaketh a barbarian, and he that speaketh shall be a barbarian unto me. Even so ye, for as much as ye are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek that ye may excel to the edifying of the church. Have you ever gone through a drive-thru where the guy mumbles into the microphone? Now, you've seen it on all sorts of things. You go up and you say, yes, I'd like it. Well, did you get that? And so they started putting those windows that tell you what you ordered so that you can know what you ordered, because you have no idea what you ordered from what the guy says you ordered, because you can't understand what the guy says. I mean, assuming he speaks English. And so there is this barrier. There is this gap in communication. Paul says, if you come into the church mumbling tongues, people are going to look at you and think that you're a barbarian. Think that you're crazy. How much better if you come into the church with something legitimate to say in your own language? With something legitimate to say that can edify the church? How much better if Paul steps up and expounds something about righteousness or about godliness instead of stepping up and speaking in an unknown tongue, which, by the way, were languages. We've talked about that. Were actual languages. It wasn't just babble. It was a real language. We know that from the book of Acts. That's not the context of tonight. But he is saying here, you are zealous after spiritual gifts, and that's good. You want to see the manifestation of the Spirit in your lives. That's good. But make sure that what you're manifesting is helping, is doing something good. Verses 13 through 17, Paul argues regarding the necessity of this understanding unto edification. Wherefore, let him that speaketh in an unknown tongue pray that he may interpret. For if I pray in an unknown tongue, my spirit prayeth, but my understanding is unfruitful. I don't even understand what I'm saying. So my spirit is praying, and I know what my spirit is praying, but my understanding is being unfruitful. What is it then? I will pray with the Spirit, and I will pray with understanding, with the understanding also. I will sing with the Spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also. So he says, rather, when I pray or when I sing, how much better if I'm praying or singing in such a way that not only is God hearing this, but I'm understanding it. So I'm being edified, and I'm edifying. This is great. Else, when thou shalt bless with the Spirit, how shall he that occupieth the room of the unlearned say amen at thy giving of thanks, seeing he understandeth not what thou sayest? For thou verily givest thanks well, but the other is not edified. So maybe, as you're speaking in tongues, you're doing a great job of giving thanks unto God. You're giving glory to God, unto God, but the person that's sitting there that doesn't know as much, that is unlearned, isn't being edified. You know, that's one of the best things about praying in the assembly, is as I hear other people's prayers, I'm learning how to pray better. As I hear somebody mention something and the Holy Spirit smites me and says, you know what, it has been weeks since you prayed for that. It's in your list. Why haven't you prayed for it? You need to pray for that. Why haven't you been praying for that? There is a mutual edification that comes. Same with singing. A mutual edification that comes when somebody gets up and sings. They're singing unto the Lord. That's what they should be doing, at least. But there is an edification value. That's why it's done. Verses 18 through 21, Paul's personal testimony regarding the use of tongues. 18 through 21, I thank my God, I speak with tongues more than ye all. Yet in the church, I had rather speak five words with my understanding than by my voice, that by my voice I might teach others also, than 10,000 words in an unknown tongue. See that? I would rather speak five words in my own understanding than 10,000 in a tongue that the people around me do not know. Brethren, be not children in understanding. Howbeit in malice be ye children, but in understanding be men. In the law it is written, with men of other tongues and other lips will I speak unto this people. And yet for all that they will not hear me, saith the Lord. So he's calling them to understand. He's giving them the personal testimony. Why why is it that these charismatic denominations, we know beyond knowledge that what they are doing when they're speaking in tongues is wrong? Because if you read 1 Corinthians 14, none of them are doing what it says. None of them are doing it properly. Not a one. And that's what Paul is testifying. I'd rather speak five words in a language that you can understand than 10,000 words in an unknown tongue. It gets better. Verses 22 to 26, Paul's revelation that the purpose of tongues is overshadowed by the superiority of prophecy. The purpose of tongues is overshadowed by the superiority of prophecy. Look with me, and here is the big kicker when it comes to speaking in tongues in this age. Wherefore tongues, now we know that we can go to the book of Acts and all of that and recognize why tongues was there, why it has passed on. But look at this. Wherefore tongues are for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. But prophesying serveth not for them that believe not, but for them which believe. What is the church for? It's for believers. It's for believers. And so when you come into the body of the church, you prophesy, you exhort, you edify, you comfort. That's not what tongues were for. Tongues aren't a sign that to me that I'm saved. Tongues is a sign to unbelievers. And so that's what Paul is saying here. I'm starting to argue the tongues thing. That's not what this is for. If therefore the whole church, verse 23, be come together into one place, and all speak with tongues, and there come in those that are unlearned or unbelievers, will they not say that ye are mad, that you're crazy? What are these people doing? They're crazy. But if all prophesy, and there come in one that believeth not, or one unlearned, he is convinced of all, he is judged of all. But if an unbeliever or one that hasn't learned much about God comes into a place where there is true truth being taught, they say, aha, that's true. They're convicted. They're convinced. They're edified. Okay. And thus, verse 25, are the secrets of his heart made manifest. And so, falling down on his face, he will worship God and report that God is in you of a truth. You want to prove that God's in you? Don't start speaking in tongues. Start speaking the truth. That's an interesting concept. How is it then, brethren, when ye come together, every one of you hath a psalm, hath a doctrine, hath a tongue, hath a revelation, hath an interpretation? Let all things be done unto edifying. That's his revelation of superiority of prophecy. Now let's look at verses 27 through 33, instructions regarding tongues and prophecy for general order in the church. If any man speak in an unknown tongue, let it be by two, or at the most by three, and that by course, and let one interpret. But if there be no interpreter, note this phrase, let him keep silence in the church. That's important to what we're talking about tonight. Verse 28, in the middle of the verse. But if there be no interpreter, let him keep silence in the church, and let him speak to himself and to God. Let the prophet speak two or three, and let the others judge. If anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace. For ye may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn, and all may be comforted. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. Do you see why it would be foolish for us to say that at the moment a woman walks into the sanctuary, she needs to shut her mouth? Do you see how that's not even at all the context of what Paul has been talking about throughout the entire chapter? Throughout the entire last three chapters, he's been talking about spiritual gifts, and all of a sudden he starts talking about how women need to shut their mouths? No. That's not how it works. That's not how Paul writes. That's not how anyone writes. That's not how the Holy Spirit's going to give it to us. Paul is talking about something else here. The word speak is found 24 times in 1 Corinthians 14 alone. It's a verb, laleo in the Greek. It's that verb for speak. In verse 2, it's found three times. In verse 3, it's mentioned in contrast to verse 2. Verse 2 speaking of speaking in tongues. Verse 3 exhorting that the one who prophesies would speak unto men to edification, to exhortation, and to comfort. That's where Paul defines the word prophecy in with those three descriptors. It's found in verse 4. It's found two times in verse 5. It's found two times in verse 6. In verse 6, it's speaking specifically of the fact that speaking in tongues is not profitable as much as would be those that speak concerning revelation, knowledge, edification, or doctrine. Prophecy is only one facet of that communication, we notice. At this point, we begin to understand what Paul means when he says speak in this chapter. He's not talking about me going up to Jared and saying, Jared, how was your week? Right? Look at verse 6. Now, brethren, if I come unto you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you, except I shall speak to you either by revelation or by knowledge or by prophesying or by doctrine. So speaking is beginning to take shape as authoritative verbal communication to the assembly. It's not simply a reference to opening one's mouth. When he's talking about tongues, he's talking about speaking in a different language. The other times he's referencing the word speak, he's referencing authoritative communication. Revelation, knowledge, prophesying, doctrine. It's found twice in verse 9. Again, that reference to authoritative speaking. Twice in verse 11, once in verse 13, once in verse 18. Verse 19, he correlates speaking to teaching in the church. Verse 21 correlates speaking with authoritative appeal to obey God, as quoted in Isaiah 28, 11 and 12. Verse 23, speaking about authoritative verbal contribution to the assembly. Verse 27, the word is found. Verse 28, a call for men to keep silence if their act of authoritative speaking, tongues, is not actually contributing to the edification of the body. But if there be no interpreter, let him keep silence in the church. If the man has nothing to say that exhorts the body, then he needs to keep silence. Does that mean that the moment he steps into the sanctuary, if what he has to say isn't going to help anyone, that he shouldn't open his mouth at all and say, hey Jared, how was your day today? No, it just means that when it's time for those to contribute, which is what oftentimes the New Testament church did, when it was contribution time, if they were just going to get up and start babbling without an interpreter, then he just needed to keep his mouth shut. That's what Paul is saying. Verse 28, the word, the Greek word there is sigato, meaning to keep silence. Verse 29, the word is found. Verse 34, verse 35, and verse 39. And so let's talk about this. Let's put the pieces together for this first particular passage. From the context, it's very clear that the overriding theme of 1 Corinthians 14 is authoritative speaking in the church, be it in tongues with an interpreter, or be it prophesying, edifying, exhorting, doctrine, those sorts of things. It's not a reference to casual speaking, and it's not a reference to asking for information. You say, what about verse 35? We'll get there. It's not even a reference to contributing information, it's a reference to authoritative contribution, whereby a person is authoritatively standing up in the church. A reference to teaching, to exhortation. So, verse 34, let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak. This is the exact same word found in verse 28. Let them keep silence in the church. As a matter of fact, with the exception of the different pronoun reference from him to her or them, it is the same phrase. Let him keep silence in the church, verse 28. Let your women keep silence in the churches, in verse 34. There's no reason to assume then that the context is any different. There's no reason to assume that because it's a blanket statement, let your women keep silence in the churches, that we should elevate that to the level of all speaking as opposed to the same silence that Paul commands the men to be engaged in verse 28, assuming they had nothing authoritatively edifying to say. So, men, when they get into the assembly, are permitted to speak authoritatively if it's going to help somebody. Women are not permitted to speak authoritatively. You see the parallel? That is what Paul is going at here. Let your women keep silence in the churches. In verse 28, the word was used to prohibit men who would try to speak in tongues without interpretation. In verse 34, it is prohibiting women from doing it at all, from attempting to speak authoritatively in the church. Let's talk about verse 35. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home. Basically, he's saying if they desire to learn something, and let me gloss it this way, let them demand it of their own husbands. If they would ask or desire to learn something, let them demand it of their husbands at home. And I say it that way because the Greek word for ask there is not the typical Greek word for ask. It's not the word that means to ask a question or to inquire. It's the word that means demand. It's the word that means expect an answer. It's literally a word that means stand in authority and demand that somebody satisfy your curiosity or your expectation. It does not reflect humble inquiry. It carries with it demand, expectation that the person will satisfy you. The typical word for asking in a request format would be aiteo, and it implies some level of submission whereby, say, a student would ask a teacher a question, and that teacher would then give an answer. That would be aiteo. On the other hand, you have a judge who is asking a defendant a question. Did you really explain to me why you were? That's epirapao, the word that's found in 1 Corinthians 14:35. So Paul, as it seems here, well, let me give you a few examples of where this same word asked, epirotao, the one that means demand, is found elsewhere in the New Testament. Matthew 12:10. And behold, there was a man which had his hand withered, and they, being the Sanhedrin, asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days? That they might accuse him. They weren't asking him to get a legitimate answer. They were asking him so they could accuse him. They'd made up their mind. It was a judgmental asking. That's this word, aprotao. How about Matthew 16:1? The Pharisees also with the Sadducees came and tempting desired, there's the word, him that he would show them a sign from heaven. They didn't come and say, teacher, give me a sign from heaven. Show me something. Teach me something. They came demanding of him that he would prove himself to them. That's this word, epirotao. Matthew 22, 23, and 24. The same day came to him the Sadducees, which say that there is no resurrection, and asked him, there's that word, saying, Master, Moses said, if a man die having no children, his brother shall marry his wife, and will raise up seed, dot, dot, dot. That was not a submissive asking in order to get an answer. That was a tempting. They didn't even believe in the resurrection, and here they are asking Jesus Christ about the resurrection. Which brother will get to marry this woman in the resurrection? They were tempting him. They were seeking to throw him off. They were demanding something of him. So Matthew 12:10, Matthew 16:1, Matthew 23:23 and 24. Acts 1:6, we find this word. When they therefore were come together, they asked of him, saying, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? That gives us a little insight into what they were thinking. See, they thought Jesus Christ was coming and was going to restore the kingdom right away. The disciples did. And they didn't ask him, Lord, give us insight. They said, Lord, is this the time now? Let's do this. And then Acts 5:27. And then this was before the council. And when they brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them. Once again, the high priest, they're brought before a council, and the high priest is demanding things of them like a judge. That's the word found in 1 Corinthians 14 for ask. Interesting. Interesting. So, 1 Corinthians 14:35. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home. For it is a shame for women to speak in the church. Do you see what Paul is saying here? If somebody gets up, and notice verse 29. Let the prophet speak two or three, and let the other judge, discern. It's possible that what would happen from time to time is somebody would get up and say, hey, I found this marvelous thing in the scriptures. And they would speak, and the others around them would say, I don't think you have that right. I don't agree with you. Let me counter what you're saying. Let me disagree with you, and let's get this right. Women do not have that privilege in the church. Can you ask legitimate questions? There's no prohibition against it. There's no prohibition against raising your hand and saying, Pastor, I have a question. What there is prohibition is when pastor says something wrong, the woman getting up and saying, nope, you're wrong. Or, oh, you got that wrong. Or, oh, you, no, that's not your place. If you want to do that, if something was wrong, if something needs to be corrected, if I said something wrong and there's a doctrinal issue and you're the only one that caught it and you're a woman in the church, you need to go to your male authority, be it coming to the pastor in private and saying, Pastor, I caught this, it was wrong, or to your father or to your husband, as the example is in the text, and say, this was wrong. And then the man brings it up in the church. That's what 1 Corinthians 14, verse 35 is talking about. Demanding, correcting. In other words, you are placing yourself in a position where you are saying, no, I am going to correct you. I am going to have that authoritative contribution to the assembly. Not permitted. That's 1 Corinthians 14. And then he goes on to talk about some extra justification with the prophecy and such. Are there any questions about this passage? Of course, we've got two more passages to cover. This is just the first prohibition, so we're not going to make any application tonight to our church. That won't happen for a couple of weeks. But are there any questions in regard to this particular passage, Mike? Certainly.
Verse 28, I'm just curious, when it then says, and let him speak to himself and to God, does that still carry that idea of speaking authoritatively? I mean, does the word speak have a distinction throughout the passage just based on the way it obviously is in the sentence, or is it the same thing?
I think I see what you're saying. The question being,
would it be wrong to speak authoritatively if they're trying to be an interpreter in this verse?
Right, well, I think...
So now he's supposed to speak to himself.
Right.
I was just curious if the speaking there is...
I think basically the idea was to speak to himself to, I guess, in himself, edify himself. Instead of speaking to the assembly in tongues, which as was found earlier in the passage. I guess verse 14 would be an example. If I pray in an unknown tongue, my spirit prayeth, but my understanding is unfruitful. Maybe not as... I'm looking for one where it talks about me being edified, but those around me couldn't. Maybe even earlier in... the passage, but he would still be edifying, so I don't think we're changing what he would say. It's just changing the venue. He's just going to keep it to himself, and it's going to be a blessing to him. So I don't think, while it's not necessarily saying, and I hope I'm answering your question, that this would still be authoritative, it's the same message as if he would speak, which would be, by intent, an authoritative message. Just if he didn't have an interpreter, then that message would not edify. Does that make sense?
More simply, I could have asked, I guess, did you say that the word speak throughout the passage always had an authoritative context to it?
Yes, as far as I can glean...
And so then I didn't know how to put that in the last part.
Right, as far as I can glean... The concept of speaking that he's talking about is not just, and what I was trying to say, that now he does parse, and I think I did mention this, a little bit between the idea of speaking in tongues and the idea of speaking, prophesying, doctrine, revelation, knowledge. And I'm not necessarily saying that those are one and the same, but what I am saying is that, yes, every single time speaking has been brought up, there is an idea that it is speaking with the intent of authority. And so while, yes, when he's speaking to himself, he would no longer necessarily be exercising that authority, it's going to be the same message. So this would be the message that he would come to anticipating an authoritative message, only there was no one to interpret it, so he just needs to keep his mouth shut. He can say the same thing in his heart. He can be built up in his heart and be edified in his heart and comforted in his heart, or he can say it in the language that everyone else speaks and that'll help. But he can't speak in tongues unless... I don't know if I've said English yet. I keep wanting to say, or he can say it in English, and that, of course, would not be right. So if I said that, filter that into Corinth, probably Greek. Just filter that for me. And Mike, you and I might be able to hammer out how we can clarify that if we need to for next week, if I need to state it in a different way. You can talk with your kids and whatnot, see if that made any sense. Any other questions? This is good. Okay, look over this passage this week. I'm also telling you now, next week we'll be in 1 Timothy 2, verses 8 through 15. The week after that we'll be in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 1 through 16, I think. I've got 6 pages of notes here, so I'm not going to try to flip through it. So if you want to look at those, feel free to do so. If you want to study this one out a bit more thoroughly and really back me into a corner next week, men, back me into a corner next week. Women, talk to your father, husband, or me personally, and then back me into a corner. And then I can back myself into a corner or whatever. We'll do that next week. Very good. Any Aiteo questions? Not Eprotao questions. Mike?
How you
doing? Doing well. Thanks for asking. That's a good Aiteo question. I like it. Jared, you doing okay? All right, very good. Let's...